Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm John McManus, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 15th of June, these are our main stories. The UN Secretary-General has called for an independent investigation into Thursday's attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. The World Health Organization says it's deeply concerned about the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but it doesn't yet constitute an international emergency. Pope Francis has criticised energy company bosses for searching for more fossil fuels despite the damage they're causing to the climate. Also in this podcast... For so long, Leonard Cohen's letters to his lover and inspiration sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars. The United Nations Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has called for an independent investigation into Thursday's attacks on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Mr. Guterres said that only the UN Security Council had the authority to establish such an inquiry.
We believe that the truth needs to be clearly established in relation to these attacks. We believe that responsibilities need to be clearly defined. And as I said to the Security Council, the world cannot afford a major confrontation in the Gulf.
The US has blamed Iran for the explosions, releasing a video it says shows Iranian special forces removing an unexploded mine from the side of one of the vessels. Speaking to the Fox and Friends programme on Fox News, President Donald Trump had this to say.
Well, Iran did do it, and you know they did it because you saw the boat. I guess one of the mines didn't explode, and it's probably got essentially Iran written all over it. And you saw the boat at night trying to take the mine off and successfully took the mine off the boat. And that was exposed, and that was their boat, that was them.
These latest attacks come at a time of escalating tensions between the US and Iran. Last month, Washington sharply tightened sanctions against Tehran, which in response has threatened to step up nuclear activity. Julian Marshall spoke to the BBC's Gary O'Donoghue in Washington and asked him how likely is an independent investigation.
Well, I think the Americans believe they've provided the evidence necessary for everyone to come to a conclusion. You heard the president there talking about the video that Central Command released that they say show this mine being removed from the boat by these small fast boats that they say the Iranians use in the Persian Gulf and then through the Straits of Hormuz as well off their southern coast. So they believe it's already established. Britain has weighed in the last couple of hours to say they think it's almost certainly an action performed by the Iranians as well. So it's difficult to see who would be trusted to do that kind of investigation. But I think the summary of all this is that we're going to get increased tensions in the next few weeks, not just because of these attacks, but because the Iranians, of course, have imposed these deadlines concerning their own economy. They're suffering particularly badly because of the sanctions that have been reimposed by the US and these waivers that have been taken away that allowed the Iranians to do some exporting of oil. And the economy is getting worse and worse. So something has got to give quite soon.
But I suppose at the very least, this call from Mr. Guterres will put the brake on any retaliatory action that the United States might have been considering.
It's possible. I mean, they have said, and the president has continued to say here, that they want to avoid any confrontation. The Secretary of Defense, Defense Secretary, has just said that they want to try and build some international consensus around what to do next. But I think the risk here is that something happens in that sort of powder keg of an area of the world that sparks a confrontation there, which could escalate seriously out of control. And that's the thing everyone's really concerned about, that someone will overstep the mark in some way or other, and there could be a serious confrontation.
It's hard to overstate the significance of the shipping route where those oil tankers were damaged. It's key to the economic interests of many world powers. All shipping traffic from energy-rich Gulf countries flows through a stretch of water called the Strait of Hormuz. It's only 33 kilometres wide. Its shores belong to Iran, Oman and the United Arab Emirates, and 30% of the world's seaborne crude oil travels through it. That's why the attack on Thursday on those two ships in the nearby Gulf of Oman is such a concern. The region's now said to be bristling with US warships. But who usually provides safe passage for vessels passing through the strait? And how do those vessels secure themselves? Julie Marshall spoke to Chronis Kapalidis, who was an officer in the Hellenic Navy for 19 years. He's navigated through the Strait of Hormuz several times. So what was it like sailing in the area?
Knowing the history of the place, even when it is quiet, one being on board the ship should always be on alert. You should always have procedures in place in order to be prepared to act fast and efficiently for the sake of safety of navigation, which means to be able to avoid the collision with any other ship in the area, but also to be prepared to deal with any unexpected threats that may occur. There is the ISPS code, which was established as a response to the threats of Al-Qaeda about targeting merchant ships back in 2004. And that specific code indicates measures that needs to be taken by ships and ports specifically when it comes to security-related issues.
What are the measures under that code?
Well, the main principle of that code is to focus on the safety and the security of the crew. All the measures indicated in the three different security levels that the code has introduced is all about the safety of the crew. Most of them are protective measures that needs to be taken in place before an incident occurs. And if an incident occurs, then what the code indicates is for the crew to be able to notify the competent authorities about the threat and then take all the necessary measures to secure that the crew is safe and secure. So it doesn't include any active measures against any threat.
I mean, are there different procedures for sailing through international waters and waters belonging to a state, or doesn't the latter arise?
The procedures are more or less the same. What is different is that you cannot have any sort of armed guards on board the ship that sails through state waters. The procedures are again the same, but what changes is the authorities that you need to notify. For example, if you're going through Iranian territorial waters and you have an incident, you need to inform the Iranian authorities, the Iranian Coast Guard and the Iranian authority, and they are the ones that are responsible to assist you in dealing with the issue. And if any other vessel, any other Navy vessel, comes to your assistance without prior authorization from the flag state, from Iran in that example, this is considered a hostile act. So we need to be very cautious on who we engage when we are in such a situation.
Chronis Kapalidis, a former officer in the Hellenic Navy, now researching maritime security at the University of Warwick here in the UK. The Emergency Committee of the World Health Organization has decided not to declare an international public health emergency as a result of the outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The disease has claimed around 1,400 lives and has now spread to Uganda. The acting chair of the Emergency Committee for Ebola, Preben Ovisland, appealed for more funding and resources to help DRC and its neighbouring countries to deal with the outbreak.
The committee is deeply disappointed that WHO and the affected countries have not received the funding and resources needed for this outbreak. The international community must step up funding and support for the strengthening of preparedness and response in the Democratic Republic of Congo and the neighbouring countries.
I asked our health correspondent James Gallagher how the committee had arrived at that decision and what it meant for the region handling the crisis.
Declaring a public health emergency of international concern, or a global emergency, is one of the most important acts the World Health Organization can take. Now, it has very specific and careful criteria that anything has to meet. And, you know, it did in West Africa when an Ebola outbreak killed more than 11,000 people. Now, they looked very closely at this. There were deeply held views. There were disagreements in the emergency committee meeting today. However, there... an overall conclusion was that, yes, at a local level in the region, in these two provinces in the DRC and on the borders with Uganda and Rwanda, there is a real emergency happening. But that is not the same as saying it is a global emergency that is affecting people all around the world. And so an element of it is the risk of international spread. There's another factor here as well, John, and that is whether declaring an emergency would have done any good. And they've concluded that it wouldn't. And actually, there was potential harms here that if people react by saying airlines stop flying to the Democratic Republic of Congo or people start closing borders, that would do more damage than it would in terms of improving things.
Well, despite that, James, the World Health Organization has issued an appeal for funding, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, all the way through this outbreak, the World Health Organization has been hugely lacking the resources that it needs to do. So between February and July of 2019, they estimate that they needed $98 million US dollars in order to, you know, just fundamentally deal with Ebola. They're about $54 million short. So they've got less than half the money donated from countries around the world to deal with the problem. And there, you heard in that clip just before I came on, basically the rest of the world needs to step up if we're actually going to deal with Ebola in Democratic Republic of Congo.
Just briefly, does it look like this outbreak is going to get worse?
Well, at the moment, the current trend is that it's getting slightly better. The number of new cases each week is declining. However, as you saw, there's always this danger that cases can drift across the border into Uganda and cases can pop up where there haven't been them before. So I don't want to have a crystal ball on this, but, you know, the range of when this could be over is anything from a few months to 2 years. So, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty about where this outbreak is going to go.
James Gallagher. Next to the Vatican, where the senior executives of oil companies have been chatting to the Pope about climate change. Pope Francis told them that global warming threatened the future of the human family. And he also said that radical changes were needed to save what he described as our common home.
Our children and grandchildren should not have to pay the cost of our generation's irresponsibility. Indeed, as is becoming increasingly clear, young people are calling for change. Dear friends, time is running out.
Radical action, of course, hasn't always been the hallmark of the companies who extract and sell fossil fuels, though in the past the Vatican Bank has refused to say whether it would join the movement to divest from fossil fuel investments. Our environment analyst Roger Harabin told me more about what the Pope had to say.
The oil bosses would have gone to the Vatican knowing that they were going to get rapped for their attitude to climate change. I mean, there are two things here. One is, I think, just on a personal level, you know, you get an invitation to see the Pope in the Vatican. Also, all of these firms have shareholders and they need a narrative to tell their shareholders. And I'm sure that was part of it as well. And there's a third reason. The BP CEO, Bob Dudley, talked about the need for all parts of society to join in, and there were groups of major investors there as well. So the oil bosses have been talking to the investors on how they can make this immense transition towards clean energy, which is, of course, so challenging for them.
The Pope's got a lot of pull. Is this likely to have made a real difference to this divestment issue?
Well, I'll just go back to Bob Dudley's comments afterwards. Firstly, he said he was honoured to participate. He talked about the Pope's convening power and how useful it was to have this dialogue with people of his stature and also major investors again and religious people together. I mean, it's a most unusual dialogue. And I'll just read a quote from him. The world needs to take urgent action to get us on a more sustainable path. OK, you normally hear that sort of thing from an oil boss, at least not that often. And it's critical that everyone plays their part, companies and investors, governments and individuals. And then he goes on to say constructive dialogues such as this meeting are essential in aligning key players on the steps needed to accelerate the energy transition while still enabling advances in human prosperity. What he means is, you know, look after our profits as well. But, you know, I think one could be cynical about this, but probably there is genuinely some good likely to come out of it.
Roger Harabin. Now, what if there was a podcast that had the power to fix all of the world's problems? Well, that might be wishful thinking, but there is a podcast from the BBC World Service that explores brilliant solutions to different problems. It's called People Fixing the World. And in recent episodes, we've heard about an ambitious project to swap mosquitoes that spread diseases with ones that don't, and the company where people are working less but getting the same amount of work done for the same pay. Find out how by searching for People Fixing the World wherever you found this podcast. As we record this podcast, emergency teams in Chile are trying to locate three miners who have become trapped some 70 metres below ground after a landslide on Thursday. Jane Chambers reports.
Contact has finally been made with the three Bolivian miners who are trapped about 70 metres underground, but it's still unclear what condition they're in. Part of the San Jose de Tocopilla mine collapsed late on Thursday evening. The Chilean authorities say specialised teams are trying to rescue them, but it's difficult because there's a large rock covering the shaft that they could use to escape. The Bolivian president, Evo Morales, has said on Twitter that he's worried about his countrymen and has thanked the Chilean president, Sebastián Piñera, for his efforts on their behalf.
Jane Chambers. A wave of demonstrations has hit Brazil cities over the issue of pension reforms. In the first general strike facing President Jair Bolsonaro, bus services were disrupted and metro lines suspended in cities right across the country. The proposed changes to pensions include setting a minimum retirement age of 65 for men and 62 for women, and there'd also be an increase in worker contributions. It's all to help the Brazilian government make savings of hundreds of billions of dollars. Our correspondent in Sao Paulo, Daniel Galas, told me more about what lay behind the protests.
There's a lot of anger against the pension reforms and what the government is proposing. It's never been easy in any country to change retirement age and retirement rules, especially in the middle of the game. But the government says it's crucial to, you know, get Brazil's economy to grow again, because a few years from now, a lot of the budget will be compromised just by spending on pensions. Of course, the labor unions, which promoted the protest today, say that the workers are the ones paying the price to get Brazil's economy going again.
Just give us a bit more detail, Daniel, about what the pension reforms actually mean.
Well, it's the biggest thing in this government of Jair Bolsonaro this year. It's trying to get Brazil to spend less with its pensions. A few years ago, Brazil's government was having surpluses, but as the population is getting older, now it's having to spend more on pensions. And a few years down the line, they say this is not going to be sustainable anymore, and this is hurting the whole of the economy. So what the government wants to do, it wants to stop that now through these reforms, which basically means getting Brazilians to work longer. There's no retirement age in Brazil, so they want to establish one for 65 for men or 62 for women, and changing a lot of the rules, especially for public servants who get very generous pensions from the system.
What do you think the effect is going to be on Mr. Bolsonaro's presidency?
Well, in terms of the strike, it's not likely to hurt him much. We've seen strikes in the past in 2017 against the previous president, and that didn't have much of an effect in the pension reforms that he was promoting. But that time, pension reforms failed because there was a huge scandal in the government. So the government has to look out in its political front. No, can it get its allies behind? Can it not have any big scandals? Because those are the game changers in Brazil, not so much these street protests.
Daniel Galas in Brazil. Now to Sudan, and the country's transitional military council has admitted it ordered the breakup of a pro-democracy camp in the capital at the start of June. The opposition says well over 100 people were killed, but the military denies allegations its security forces raped women, men and children during the attack. Protesters blame the government militia known as the Rapid Support Forces for leading the violence. The BBC's Catherine Bayarohanga has been listening to people who say they saw sexual crimes being committed. Some people may find parts of this report distressing.
I'm standing by a busy road junction in Khartoum. When we were here a few weeks ago, there were thousands of people here. And in front of me is the railway bridge, where young men would sit and start banging it with stones, chanting. But now listen to it. It's all gone. We've heard about the dozens of people who were killed on the 3rd of June, but that wasn't the limit of the atrocities committed here.
We saw six soldiers that were raping two girls. We made some noise at them. Go away, go away.
I meet a young man who was at the protest that day. He clearly was never the biggest of men, but it looks like his experience and the things he saw have left him shrunken even further. He says he was a witness to some of the sexual violence committed by the government's Rapid Support Forces, a militia increasingly known by its former name, the Janjaweed.
We found the two girls. We took them to the nearby mosque. They didn't say anything. I tried to make them feel better, but they didn't stop screaming.
His hand is heavily bandaged. His eyes well up with tears, though he really does not want to cry. He paid a heavy price for rescuing those girls.
I was captured by a group of soldiers. One of them was one of the six who were raping the girls. Because he pushed me to the floor and brought out a long piece of steel like, I will do to you what I wanted to do earlier. They were trying to take off my clothes and to rape me. After like 3 minutes or 4 minutes, gunshots started under us. They looked around the office and said, it's better for us to get out.
Getting a complete picture of how many women, men and children were sexually assaulted is very difficult. The internet was shut down by the military. Many are also too scared to speak out.
Having numbers right now is not going to be possible.
Suleyma Sharif is a counsellor at the Yathad Trauma Centre. She and other colleagues have helped 12 women who were raped. Suleyma also worked in Darfur, where the Janjaweed committed mass atrocities, including rape.
I went to the sitting area after 2 days because there's so many people missing. Everything is destroyed. So it's the same thing when you pass by villages in Darfur. I don't think they do it for sex. It's all about degradation, humiliation, and beating up the spirit. So I think this is part of what they did in Darfur. They did it as a weapon of war. So now it's just mean as a mean of weapon to kill up the revolution.
The military council denies any sexual crimes have been committed in the crackdown on protesters. Lieutenant General Shams El-Din Kabashi is its spokesperson.
This is something that doesn't match the reputation of the armed forces or of the Sudanese people. The false information that's being spread is designed to mislead.
Nearly 2 weeks later, and the government militia still dominate this city, and it means some of their victims relive their traumatic experiences every time they leave their homes.
That report by Catherine Bayarohanga in Sudan. Now, in France, there's been a lot of conversation recently online and in kitchens about a certain cooking appliance. An investigation has shown that one of the Lidl supermarket's top-selling kitchen appliances, a food processor called Monsieur Cuisine, contains a hidden microphone. Luke Jones spoke to Marie Turkin, the editor-in-chief of the Numerama website in Paris, who carried out the investigation. He began by asking Ms. Turkin why people hadn't realised their appliances had an extra unusual element.
Oh, honestly, I have no idea because there's actually a hole in that is very, very much visible when you look at the thing. But the thing is, because nobody actually looks at those appliances, nobody took notice. So what happened is we realized that two French men, managed to hack the tablet that is inside this appliance, and they managed to actually have a conversation with Discord, which is an app. And so they actually started to talk to each other via this kitchen appliance. And so they told me that because I got in touch with them, asking if I could learn a little bit more about what they did to this object. And so that's when they told me that there was a microphone. And that's what I was quite shocked to learn that. And that's when I knew something was strange. So I asked them to elaborate on this microphone thing. And that's when we realized that nobody actually knew that there was a microphone because it wasn't written anywhere in the fine print or on the websites that I've talked about this object. So that was when we started to discover the hidden microphone that is very much we are very much capable of working, making it work.
And of course, some people are joking about this online. There are lots of messages saying Monsieur Cuisine is watching you. There's a spy inside Monsieur Cuisine. But of course, I imagine there are very serious privacy concerns as well, are there not?
Yeah, exactly. I think, I mean, nobody is going to actually just listen to you making your soup in your kitchen at night. It's not, this is not the main concern, but the main concern is that we discovered the product is actually running Android 6, which is a very early version of Android, and it is dated. The last security patch is dated 2 years ago, which means that for 2 years there haven't been any modification that could secure the product. So that means lots of things could happen One of them, obviously, is taking control of the microphone, but this is the most far-fetched thing that could happen, because there are many other easier things to do with a connected object that is not very much secured. You could use it to make a DDoS attack. You could use it to mine bitcoins. Yeah, listening to you is one of the options, but it's not really the most likely to happen.
And has there been a reaction from the manufacturers? What have they said?
The thing is, so Lidl is working with a Chinese manufacturer that is impossible to join. But we joined Lidl 3 days ago and asked them for answers. They couldn't get us an answer because honestly, I think they're just. They don't know what they have. They were discovering the thing as we were discovering it. So when we first told them there was a microphone, another French media called a French guy, and he said that he had no idea there was a microphone. And then 2 hours later, he called back and he said, "Oh yes, of course we know there's a microphone, but don't worry, it's secure." But they don't really know what secure means because they just say, "Yeah, it's used to just cook, so it's not dangerous."
Marie Turkin, the editor-in-chief of Numerama in Paris. Now, it became one of the great love affairs of the 1960s, a hard-up poet inspired by his Norwegian muse to create music that for many defined an era. Now, dozens of letters chronicling the romance between Leonard Cohen and Marianne Ihlen have sold at auction for a total of nearly $900,000. Many of them went for five times their pre-sale estimate. As our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson explains, the letters offer an insight into the mind of the songwriter and the woman who sparked his creativity.
Somehow I was his muse in those days.
The Norwegian Marianne Ihlen.
Doesn't he somewhere say, "Thank you, Marianne, for making me so miserable that I had to write or create or something"? I took that as a compliment. It is a compliment.
The subject of one of Leonard Cohen's most famous songs.
Not so long, Marianne.
They met in 1960 on the Greek island of Hydra. She was married with a young child, but they were soon a couple. And that relationship was captured in a series of 50 love letters which had been sold at auction. Christie's describes the archive as providing fascinating glimpses of the young poet's yearnings and artistic struggles. Leonard Cohen once explained to Norwegian radio what it was about Marianne which had captivated him.
She was one of the most modest people about her beauty. And she had that other side, too, where she'd drink wine and dance and become wild and beautiful and threatening and dangerous.
She inspired a number of his most famous songs, including "Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye" and "Bird on the Wire."
Like a bird on the wire.
The relationship ended when she was replaced in his affections by another woman immortalized in song.
Suzanne takes you down to her.
But they remained friends and corresponded right up until they both died within a few months of each other in 2016. It was Marianne's family who decided to put their correspondence up for sale, and much of it is very poetic. In one letter sent from Tel Aviv in 1960, Leonard Cohen concluded, "It's hard to write you. The surf is too loud, the beach is too crowded, and you're too much in my heart to put anything down."
Goodbye.
That report by Colin Patterson and the letters of Leonard Cohen.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah.
And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm John McManus, and until next time, goodbye.